Welcome to the Federal Society's Practice Group podcast. The following podcast, hosted by the Federal Society's Criminal Law and Procedure Practice Group, was recorded on Monday, December 11, 2017, during a live Courthouse Steps teleforum conference call held exclusively for Federalist Society members.
Welcome to the Federal Society's teleforum conference call. This afternoon, we'll be hosting a Courthouse Steps conversation, Marinello v. United States. My name is Wesley Hodges, and I'm the Associate Director of Practice Groups at the Federal Society. As always, please note that all expressions of opinion are those of the expert on today's call. Today we are happy to have with us Mr. Ted Cooperstein, who is General Counsel at the United States Office of Personnel Management. After remarks from Ted, we will move to an audience Q&A. Thank you for speaking with us today, Ted. The floor is now yours.
Thank you, Wes. It's a privilege here to be speaking with the Federalist Society. I just want to start with my own personal disclaimer that what I'll be discussing today are only my own personal observations and opinions, and speaking solely for myself, not for the United States government, Department of Justice, or the Office of Personnel Management. I was just attending this Supreme Court oral argument, much like any other member of the public or the Supreme Court bar, and I do no longer any criminal practice in my current position, but had committed to this Courthouse Steps beforehand. With that said, let me proceed to discuss the case of Carl Marinello versus the United States. It was a criminal tax case, and in such it focused on Title 26 of the United States Code, specifically Section 7212A, and what's been referred to as the Omnibus Clause. This is a provision in the statute in the criminal tax code that forbids acting in a corrupt manner or endeavoring a corrupt endeavor to frustrate the administration of the tax code. And this is what the focus of the argument was about. The facts of the case were that Mr. Marinello is in the Western District of New York and owns and runs a courier business operating principally between the United States and Canada. For about a decade or more, he paid no taxes. He filed no tax returns with the IRS for either corporate or personal returns. And the way he ran his business was a minimal footprint. He paid his employees in cash, gave them no W-2s or any tax documents. And as a matter of course, in his business practice, he consistently and systematically destroyed his business records. That includes his bank account records, business receipts, bills, employee work statements, and the like. He used the corporate funds to his regular personal use, blurring the line between the corporate and personal assets of the firm, paying a number of mortgages, the briefs list that he was financing his mother's living expenses and had weekly directed cash contributions to his wife. In 2004, the first tip reached the IRS about Mr. Marinello. They took a look at him and his business, but with the superficial preliminary examination, they really couldn't determine whether he owed taxes or not. They reopened their investigation in 2009, and as part of that investigation, they interviewed Mr. Marinello, where he stated that he had not filed any taxes, admitted to the fact of filing no returns, and justified that on the basis that he made less than $1,000 a year and therefore was not required to file anything. This is, in fact, false because the government was able to determined from examining bank accounts and a number of records from his customers that he had gross receipts in the hundreds of thousands of dollars every year and then also had transfers into his personal account in the tens of thousands of dollars. Eventually, he admitted that he knew he had to file his tax returns, but he, quote, never got around to it. So he was indicted by the IRS and the government, charged with one felony count of the corrupt endeavor to obstruct and impede the due administration of the Internal Revenue Code under 7212. Along with that, there were eight more counts of the willful failure to file tax returns in violation of 26 U.S. Code Section 7203, and those are each misdemeanor counts. So there was one felony count and eight misdemeanors. He actually went to a jury trial. He claimed that there was no criminal intent to what he did, but he otherwise conceded all of the acts we just discussed. And the court gave an instruction to the jury that defined the charge, the element of having acted corruptly, was to mean that he had intended to secure an unlawful advantage or benefit and intended to impede or obstruct the due administration of the Internal Revenue Code. The jury came back with a verdict that convicted Marinello on all nine counts. He first raised his challenge to the statute as part of his motion for a new trial, which was denied. He raised an appeal to the Second Circuit Court of Appeals, which affirmed his conviction, and it is now pending before the Supreme Court on certiorari. So to quote the question presented from the cert petition in the briefs, is whether a conviction under 26 U.S.C. 7212A for corruptly endeavoring to obstruct or impede the due administration of the tax code requires proof that the defendant acted with knowledge of a pending IRS investigation or proceeding. So Mr. Marinello is arguing that he should not be convicted because a lot of the bad acts, if you will, that he's charged with doing took place well before the IRS knew about him or opened the case or actually notified him of an audit or proceeding. The argument opened with the counsel stressing the statutory interpretation of the 7212 section. He looked to parallel the structure that it was borrowed from the criminal code, Title 18, Section 1503, on obstruction of justice, and that statute specifies the similar language of obstructing or impeding the administration of justice, the due justice of the court. And he pointed to the prior case law that restricts that statute in Title 18 to conduct that occurs during an ongoing trial or other court proceeding, a grand jury or a petty jury. He says that, therefore, it's overbroad the way the government is currently applying Section 7212 in the tax code, and that it will reach so far as to criminalize legal conduct. Justice Ginsburg opened up with the first question from the bench, and she asked him, well, what types of legal conduct are you implying this would cover? And the response was, for instance, paying cash to vendors, say you were paying your local gardener cash. And the objective question there is the mens rea involved. Well, why did you pay the cash, and for what purpose? Was it for a purpose of an unlawful benefit? And then Justice Sotomayor focused on the acts of the IRS and the IRS agent. So she was seeking to propose a limiting principle, and she asked, can it be that the for administration wording of the statute, that would be the part that would be frustrated, the acts of an agent or agencies? She had the hypothetical, suppose an agent had made a telephone call to your client, the defendant, and he stated, much as he did in the interview, I'm making less than $1,000, and that would be a false statement. She asked, was that sufficient to violate 7212? The defendant tried to say no, that there were other crimes that would cover that, and those were just misdemeanors for making a false statement. Justice Sotomayor continued to focus on the word administration, and she actively went into detail about the active obstruction of the work of the agency, whether that would be sufficient to bring it within the statute. And the defendant's answer was that this is already covered by other crimes, and it would be duplicative then to extend this felony to cover those types of things. So Chief Justice Roberts then was asking, well, what's happening on the ground? He seemed very interested in the practical aspects of the statute, and so what's the frequency of these charges? How often does it happen? And the defense counsel said, well, there had really been no prosecutions of the statute for almost the first 30 years after it was enacted. Then the frequency picked up in the 1990s and then after 2000. And then he went on to transition to discuss how another incidence of overreach in his mind was the failure to file becomes a predicate for these types of cases. Stephen Breyer intervened then to ask, well, let's return to that idea of the gardener, or say somebody who comes to plow the snow off your driveway. You're not going to give them a Form 10-99. Well, every one of those people go to jail then under the statute. And the defendant admitted that, well, it comes down to the culpable intent of the mens rea. Samuel Alito then asked, well, does your dividing line here solve the problem, even if we take what the defendant asked for, the line to say that there has to be an actual official proceeding commenced? The conduct is still a problem if it occurs after a proceeding begins. And he suggested that you have a disagreeable taxpayer who delays, misses meetings, is late with his documents and so forth. Isn't that the same situation? And the defense counsel stuck to his bright line of the formal notice of an audit that then permits prosecution, and that then would be prosecutable as a criminal act. Elena Kagan then jumped in, and she was trying to seek a limiting principle as well. And she asked the defendant to elaborate on his limiting principle of that, because she thinks it comes out of thin air, that there's no grounding in the text of the statute, and wanted him to elaborate on that, explain. So the defense counsel talked about the history of the codification of the Internal Revenue Code, all the other statutes of obstruction directed toward the phrase due justice. The obstruction of due justice had in fact been limited to the interference with actual officers or the actual pending proceeding in the court. And so he argued for the same parallel structure, since it had the same structure, the same verbs, and the same wording, that there should therefore be applied the same way to 7212, but he admitted that there was no legislative history to help him with that argument. And then he would try to elaborate other ways that the unwary taxpayer could be trapped, for instance, making false statements or improper information on W-4s or other tax filings. Justice Gorsuch then raised the issue of the rule of lenity, which had been pleaded in the briefs, and so he asked the defense counsel just what exactly should be the role that lenity plays in this. And the defendant discussed lenity as really being nothing else, if nothing else were to solve it at the end of all the statutory analysis. He offered it as a tiebreaker in favor of his client. So Stephen Breyer then brought it back to, he was always very insistent on focusing on just what is the key issue and nothing else, and he kept coming back to say, so the nub of this case is that one word, administration, in place of justice in the statute, and the defendant agreed with him. At this point, you got the impression that Justice Breyer was tossing some softballs as a friendly questioner. The defendant agreed with that, and then Stephen Breyer elaborated that basically you're looking for the nexus of the conduct to be a connection to a pending proceeding. Justice Kagan protested that she didn't see it was ambiguous enough for lenity. She thinks that the statute's not ambiguous. It's just, as she said, ungodly broad. And then Justice Sotomayor returned to the idea of use of force in the parallel language about interfering with officers in both the administration of justice or in the administration of the tax code. And by referring to that, she thought the language applies implies that there's an affirmative act needed, aimed to be aimed at the agent or the agency. And then Justice Gorsuch seemed to join in when he said, officer language in the officer case does seem to help you. And the defendant ended his time by saying, well, we'll take that if we win. So at that point, the government stood up to speak for the respondent. And the assistant to the Solicitor General, Mr. Parker, was hammering a theme of the phrase he liked to use often was the natural tendency to obstruct, and that was his attempt to distinguish what is the corrupt element of these obstruction that this statute targets. The corrupt nature of the conduct coupled with mens rea is what would make the distinctive elements, so they create distinctive elements apart from other individual instances of tax crimes and the separate misdemeanors taken alone, but in the pattern and practice would constitute the entire nature of the conduct. The justices jumped right in to start throwing some hypotheticals at him and quizzes. Justice Sotomayor started asking, well, what about somebody who just decides to roll the dice with a risky tax shelter? And the government said, well, that's not a crime without the specific intent to violate the tax laws. Justice Gorsuch returned to the snow shoveler that Justice Breyer had mentioned and got the Solicitor General to admit that that is, in fact, a technical violation when he knows that he is taking the cash in derogation of the law. But his question really was boiled down to how does someone know that they're going to be in trouble? Where's the line of what is and is not going to be prosecutable activity? He sought to equate the government's arguments with the prior honest services fraud cases and the corruption cases like McDonnell, and said that the government's argument just sounded entirely too much like the argument of trust us, we know mens rea when we see it. And he thought that that would invite a vagueness challenge to the statute, at, as he said, at the back end. So the government lawyer brought up 3 points that he thought were key to sustain the statute. The first, again, is this phrase, the natural tendency to obstruct, that there would be an objective fact nexus leading to the concept of the endeavor to frustrate the administration of the tax code. Second, he reiterated the necessity of the specific intent element to obstruct the administration of the tax code. At which point Justice Alito interrupted him to ask him, well, how do you define the word impede? He had a dictionary citation that included merely to slow or to delay a result or conclusion. So that led him to ask, is there anything that would slow or delay the IRS? Is that sufficient to create a violation of this statute? And that brought the Assistant Solicitor General back to his third point, which is that the effort to actually conduct lawful to connect lawful conduct, convert the lawful conduct into an unlawful manner to obtain an unlawful benefit, that would entail the actual corrupt endeavor. So basically he was making the point that you had to pair that conduct with other efforts to mislead or to deceive the IRS. And this is something that the justices then were to seize on in terms of discussing affirmative acts. Judge Breyer elicited from the government counsel the admission or the confirmation that it is a specific intent crime, that you have to know that the law was broken, that you are acting contrary to a specific law. Then Justice Ginsburg rejoined their discussion. She wanted to discuss the overlap of the felony and misdemeanor provisions and asked, aren't there other crimes on the books also going to fall into this obstruction statute? And the government went on to say how the elements under 7212 were different because they include the elements of corruption, the intent to obstruct, and the willful acts or willful failures to act, all in combination, as opposed to a discrete instance of the separate other statutory violations. This brought Justice Kagan then to ask, well, was this really only a difference in mens rea? And the government added that there's that plus the natural tendency to obstruct, the phrase that he was hammering home. If people fail to file, for anyone to elaborate that, if people fail to file their tax returns for non-corrupt reasons, then it is possible. He mentioned someone might say, well, it's really not worth the effort. My refund's too small. I'm not going to bother filing. He said that would not be a crime. Certainly not under the felony corruption statute. Or similarly, the failure to keep one's records. Someone could just decide, well, it clutters my home. I don't like looking at it. Each of those, he said, technically could be a willful violation of the misdemeanor statute, but neither would be enough to have the obstruction felony statute come into play. The Chief Justice quoted from the government's brief that the use of the phrase cantankerous, that some of these taxpayers would just be cantankerous. He asked if that was a small number or what would be the percentage. The government said, well, there'd be no unlawful advantage in somebody being cantankerous just by himself, so that would not be an actionable crime, and referred to their own statistics that said only 4% of their cases, brother brought and charged, actually include this 7212 section provision. This led the Chief Justice to ask whether the DOJ policy is to charge the most serious crime. There was an extended discussion of what we used to call the Ashcraft memo. I suppose now it's been superseded by a Sessions memo, but it's basically the directive of the department to their prosecutors that everybody should seek to charge the most serious yet provable crime in making their charging decisions. This led Justice Kennedy to speak up for the first time, where he asked if the court should be concerned if, for instance, up to 80% of the misdemeanor cases could fall under this felony statute. The government said, no, you should not be concerned because you still need the mens rea to truly complete the felony. And Justice Gorsuch returned again to the language about obstruct and impede, and he tried to seek a limiting principle here by looking at the focus or the object of the language. So he said when you know of something, you're obstructing something or impeding something, he said it all directs towards an object, a something. But he wanted to make sure that it was something more specific than what he had earlier called the brooding omnipresence or the government's argument that everyone should know that the tax law and the tax administration, the tax system is ubiquitous and continuous. So the government clarified that by saying, well, specifically, a defendant needs to be shown to be intending to obstruct the administration of the Internal Revenue Code, and that the administration term, unlike the term of justice, which requires a discrete proceeding, such as a court case, the routine administration of justice is, routine administration of the tax code is year-round. It entails the routine and predictable schedule throughout the year that people know and can usually and reasonably foresee what will be required of them under the tax code, and therefore they know what is going on even outside of any court proceeding in the administration of the tax code by the Internal Revenue Service. So Justice Breyer then tried to characterize the government's argument with 3 points. He first saw them as saying, well, don't worry, we will interpret the law properly. He thought that was unacceptable as a basis for ruling. And he added that the second point, that the traditional exercise was to limit the reach of the federal criminal law. And third, when you have the identical language of these other statutes concerning obstruction and the justice proceedings that then applied these principles to that statute, you wound up limiting it to a court proceeding. So he was asking why they shouldn't just do the same thing here with this tax code statute. And the government helpfully pointed out that the Congress did something contrary to that assumption when they actually legislated another section, that's number 1505 in Title 18, where they extended the protection otherwise applied in actual district court and trial court proceedings against obstruction. They extended that also to the operation of administrative agencies as well as the courts. And so the government argued that the affirmative act of the Congress to actually spell this out highlights the differences between the statutes that focus on obstruction of justice as opposed to the statute here that focuses on obstruction of the administration of the Internal Revenue Code. At this point, the government's time was just about up, so they concluded that principles were available other than what the petitioner was asking for. They conceded that you could just exclude acts of omissions by themselves, because the court had in fact done that in what's famously known as the Spies case, and that dealt with tax evasion. And in that case, the principle was that a mere omission or failure to do something was not sufficient to prove evasion. You needed a more affirmative corroborating evidence in order to demonstrate the specific intent mens rea. And so they held that that would be acceptable for the government's point of view in this case, but that again would still not help Marinello because he took affirmative acts by destroying his records and concealing things and otherwise lying to the agents and so forth, all in a pattern and practice. The second point the government ended with was that obstruction at the front end, so to speak, precludes prosecution at the back end, that if we permit the taxpayers in these situations to begin obstructing so early before there's any formal proceeding or investigation that ultimately it will frustrate any investigation. In this case specifically, Mr. Marinello couldn't be charged with tax evasion because the IRS couldn't figure out what the actual tax deficiency was and the amount because there were no records, and that's all due to Mr. Marinello's specific plan and program of destroying records. So a obstructive taxpayer sufficiently with foresight could contrive to limit his own penalties to a misdemeanor or even no penalty at all if he's thoroughly and early enough destroying all his records so that the government could never actually charge or punish him for that. There was a brief rebuttal then from Mr. Marinello's counsel. The counsel just stood up to highlight the need to place limits on the prosecutor. He noted that also that it wasn't just a matter of convictions when people go to trial, but that there was a large amount of leverage available to the federal prosecutor that leads to guilty pleas. when their charge is, as he argued, overbroad on this principle, on this statute. But he accepted that other limitations were possible, specifically the limitation based on whether and when there was an interaction with the IRS, its agent or its agency, and the defendant taxpayer, and he thought that that could closely approximate the requirement he initially asked for in his brief for the bright line of a proceeding having actually been initiated. And then Justice Breyer got the last word in by focusing again on the fact that it really boils down to that one word, administration, and what they can do with it in this statute. So that concludes my summary, Wes, and with that, I'll be happy to take any questions or discussion.
Wonderful. Let's go ahead and move to audience questions then. While we allow for audience questions to build, I just want to ask, Ted, what way do you think this case will go?
I'm not 100% confident in predicting the outcome. I do think it's interesting to note that while it's a criminal case, it's a tax case, and it tends to afford some opportunity for the justices to deviate from their expected or stereotypical positions in a criminal defense case. I think it's fairly clear that Justices Breyer and Kagan and probably Sotomayor are going to err on this, be more on the side of the petitioner, the defendant. I actually think that Justice Ginsburg may be a little bit more pro-government than usual in this type of tax case. It's also difficult to predict with any accuracy what Justice Alito and Justice Gorsuch are thinking as a result of their questions, because they're just probing both sides pretty closely. I think what I can safely say is that there will be some limiting of the statute as a result of this opinion and this case result, but I suspect it will not go far enough to actually help poor old Mr. Marinello, because I think he's still going to be convicted and guilty regardless of where they draw the line on what does and does not fall under this statute, because he had too many affirmative acts in a long pattern and practice of destructive behavior and affirmative acts, not just negligent or absent-minded failures to do things, but he was pretty well implicated by his conduct to be hiding and evading the tax system.
Thank you. Looks like we do have one question in the audience queue. Everyone, if you'd like to ask a question, please enter the star key and then the pound key. Let's move to our first audience question.
The history of tax prosecution, starting right after the tax code was created, was that the judges tended to be very inhospitable to the IRS's contentions, and they were immune to prosecution by the IRS because they had they did not have to pay income taxes, because that would have been an unconstitutional reduction of their salaries. And so as long as those judges were the main judicial force, or the numbers, they tended to side with the taxpayer over the IRS. And then once the IRS had the ability to prosecute judges, judges became much more favorable to the IRS, because they were afraid that if they went against the IRS too often, they would find themselves at the wrong end of a tax prosecution, the tax code being so complicated that anybody could be convicted of something under the tax code. It seems to me that would you say that's turning around a little bit with a case like this?
Well, that's interesting, because I wasn't aware of that viewpoint or history, if it's in fact widespread or true. And in fact, in discussions of this case in particular, and even if you read the briefs, there really is very little, if any, mention of the trial judge or any role he had, aside from highlighting what the jury instruction was that the court gave with regard to how to define a corrupt endeavor. I had thought it was worthy maybe a little greater emphasis. I didn't quite hear it from the government's point of view, but when you reread the transcript, you could see a little mention of it. I just would have emphasized it better, more forcefully. When the Chief Justice and the other justices were asking about how to rely on the restraint, if you will, of the prosecutors of the Department of Justice, or what was the actual policy with regard to charging the most serious provable crime and so forth, I'm guessing that the Assistant Solicitor General didn't have the prior background as an AUSA to be able to roll that trippingly off his tongue automatically, but it would have been just a matter of stating that, you know, we don't charge these things unless they're readily provable and we have the evidence. And a reference to the U.S. Attorney's Manual would also have bolstered the argument that the policy is not to even indict anything unless you feel you have sufficient proof to go beyond a reasonable doubt and meet the conviction standard. So these are all things that would have been there. The other interesting thing that so the dog that didn't bark was there was no mention of the fact, even though they alluded to the mens rea and specific intent requirements, that, as I understand it, is specifically from the case history of the criminal tax laws, that we have things such as the advice of counsel defense and other instructions, because it's specifically the tax laws themselves that have historically been so complicated to know that we not only want to make sure people truly understood what it was that they were violating and that they knew they were violating the law, but also encourage them to seek out legal advice and legal counsel. So all of those, I think, would have been helpful for the government to mention, but of course, you know, it's always easier when you're sitting in the audience to criticize what somebody's saying up there. But I'm not aware of any of the interactions with the actual judges or historical practice in that regard.
Thank you, caller, for your question. It looks like the audience queue is currently open. If you'd like to ask a question, please enter the star key and then the pound key. We have telephone calls every day this week, and our next telephone conference call is scheduled for tomorrow, December 12th, at noon Eastern. And it'll be on a new book by Professors Thomas West and Eric Claes titled The Political Theory of the American Founding. Please keep an eye out for emails announcing upcoming telephone calls, and you can also consult a full roster of recorded podcasts of these telephones on our website at fedsoc.org. Give a few more moments for anyone to ask a question. Please enter the star key and then the pound key if you'd like to do so. In the meantime, Ted, are there any remarks that you'd like to make before we close the call today?
Well, I'm not sure I have anything else to add. I'm pretty much between answering that question and my summary. It would be interesting to see just what the breakdown of the justices is and just how far they may go. I'm not really sure from his questioning whether Justice Gorsuch is going to be on the defendant's side or if he may issue a sort of a more individualized, particular concurring or dissenting opinion. But since I don't know that Justice Ginsburg is an automatic defense vote, it'd be interesting to see just how it breaks down, whether it'll be 5-4 or 6-3, something like that.
Wonderful. Well, it's certainly a one-of-a-kind case this term. Well, on behalf of the Federal Society, I'd like to thank Ted for the benefit of his valuable and time and expertise today. We welcome all listener feedback by email at info@fedsoc.org. Thank you all for joining us today. This call is now adjourned.
Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed this Practice Group podcast. For materials related to this podcast and other Federalist Society multimedia, please visit the Federalist Society's website at fedsoc.org/multimedia.